Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and TurfNet.com. And this week I'll be speaking with my old pal, guy who chaired the search committee for my first job when I got hired at Michigan State, Professor Bruce Branham from the University of Illinois, continuing our journey through the Big Ten Turf professors. Before we get to our conversation, just a heads up for what's new at TurfNet.com. Of course, the big news, as soon as you get to the website, is you see another friend of mine, Brad Klein, just received the highest honor from the American Golf Course, the American Golf Course Architects, Association of Golf Course Architects. Well, let's put it this way. The guys who wear the plaid jackets have given Brad Klein their highest honor, which is the Donald Ross Award. And I've known Brad quite a while. Brad and I started writing together. He enlisted me in writing for the original Golf Week Superintendent News publication, and himself a scholar of Donald Ross, and I'm sure been a good friend and good friend to the golf superintendent, and also a good friend to the golf course architect, writing about the kinds of things that architects do in a way that's allowed a deeper understanding across the board. So congrats to our friend Brad Klein on that great award. Now, in the video section, you'll see Kevin Ross and in another contraption, he's built a wagon for removing cores from the putting surfaces. Very interesting little contraption using a golf cart axle and a wheelbarrow. You know, always worth a good laugh watching Kevin Ross build stuff and do stuff out there in the Rocky Mountains. And then on the blogs, Jim McLaughlin's piece on how to keep the 50-plus-year-old superintendent careers going strong. I'm always happy to see those kinds of articles. Being a 50-plus guy myself, keeping that career energized, especially for golf course superintendents, is a very important skill, and we can only hope that everybody over 50 knows how to work the podcasts and can actually listen to this particular radio show. And when we come back after this message from our sponsors, the Aquatrols people have been sponsoring this show since we got started, we'll start with our conversation with Professor Branham.
From day to day and season to season, you never know what nature has in store for you. That's why Revolution from Aquatrols is trusted by superintendents worldwide in a variety of climates. More than 10 years of university trials have shown that Revolution is a superior surfactant for optimizing soil moisture. Whether you're battling too much rain or not enough, Revolution can help you attain the proper moisture balance in the root zone for healthy, resilient turf and drier, firmer playing surfaces. Revolution from Aquatrols, the world leader in...
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and TurfNet.com, and with me on this episode is Professor Bruce Branham of the University of Illinois. And I've known Bruce, as I said earlier, for 25 years now. We worked together at Michigan State University, and then after a career there, he moved on to the University of Illinois. I went on to Wisconsin and now ultimately at Cornell. And in your travels, Bruce, one of the things that you know I noticed from knowing you was that you know, early on, doing your PhD in Al Turgeon's lab, working with Dave Wiener, Wiener, that's not really the language we want to use, but the guys at Illinois at the time, you know, you started out doing herbicide chemistry, and in fact, I think your PhD was on the fate of diazinon, wasn't it?
It sure was. Well, you're well read, Frank. I started out doing a lot of pesticide chemistry and so on because I was I had a degree in chemistry, and that's why actually Al Turgeon recruited me to work there. So
were you doing chemistry at the U of I at the time?
Yeah, Yeah, I was an undergrad chemistry major, and I thought I needed some lab experience. I went over and saw this guy who needed some help, and over in the ornamental horticulture building, and I went over and talked to Al Turgeon, and here I am, 35, 40 years later.
So you actually have all your degrees from the U of I.
I do.
Right, you know, all these years, I didn't know that. So that's always an interesting factoid. So let's get started, though, because what I want to talk to you about today is really to draw on your, you know, long history with nitrogen. And in fact, you know, probably around the time we met in the early 90s, when Eric Miltner was wandering around the halls at MSU with a number of other grad mm-hmm. students, Steve Keeley as well. Was that really with Eric the beginning of your work in the nitrogen area?
Absolutely. Yep. In fact,
so that's
we
when you
also were, I'm sorry, we were also doing pesticide leaching studies in those big lysimeters we had there. So it was a combination of pesticide leaching and nitrate work, and or nitrogen work, and the nitrogen fate work really turned out to be the big story there. We never could detect many of the pesticides. I think part of the problem is we had this, you know, a meter deep core of soil and a fairly heavy soil. It takes a long time for pesticides. I think we'd waited another year or two and kept monitoring, we might have started seeing something, you know, but the nitrogen worked out really well. That was the centerpiece of that study.
Yeah, that Kevin Frank continued on, and are they still collecting data on those trials?
I hope so. Those are the most valuable, you know, experimental units that are around. In fact, that was part of the idea, was that we've got these four cores up there that are intact. You can monitor everything that comes out of them, and you can start looking at things. You know, the problem we have in turf is really one where, you know, we want to do a study and get it published. We take a year, maybe 2 years worth of data, and we publish it. But, you know, the reality is you're going to manage a golf course or a turf for years, sometimes decades. And so you've got all this stuff going on for 10, 15, 20 years, and we never really look at what happens that far out. And that's the advantage of those plots up there, is those are kind of a look back in time. We have soil samples from when they started. We can look at what the soil looks like now. And plus, you know, you can see the effects of, and that's a great study Kevin Frank did, by the way, is showed that turf actually does leach nitrogen. You know, there was a lot, you can find a lot of studies that show there's, you know, this stuff is great. There's no leaching out of turf, no matter how much nitrogen you pour on them. Well, he did it where you did it for, you had the same program, you know, 2 pounds of N, 5 pounds of N every year for 3 or 4 years. And then you look at it and you see that nitrogen was actually pouring out of those systems. So
yeah, I think it was what, in years 8 through 10 that they really started to leak out.
I don't know if it may have been less than that. It may only have been like 4 or 5 years, but they were getting out of the 5 pounds of N, which is a lot of nitrogen, okay? But they were getting consistently 20 to 25 parts per million of nitrate and nitrogen in the leachate, which is 2 to 2.5 times the drinking water standard. And even from the 2 pounds of N, which is, you know, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. So we're having a little timing problem. I think my voice sometimes is a little bit delayed. But I'm glad you brought up the leaching component, because I want to pivot now to, you know, the work that you finished up and got that work at MSU going. Eric got finished up. You had started some of that fate work. But then when you went to Illinois, you got Brian Horgan and then Inglesjord looking at more of a mass balance thing. And I want to specifically talk a little bit about this perennial rye, Kentucky bluegrass mass balance stuff. We talked with Brian in our first episode about, you know, sort of mass balance. What is that? You know, how do we, you know, trying to find all the nitrogen that we put down. And he did a pretty good job of outlining all the various fates. But I'm particularly interested in this ammonium sulfate study, Bruce, because in this study it appears that you really looked at species differences, number one,
right,
and then the role that thatch plays in these systems. So, because I'm building towards the whole idea of organic matter accumulation and the sort of nutrient richness that thatch provides. You actually separated out thatch and mat in the study,
right,
and looked at, you know, absorption there. So let's talk. Why don't you talk a little bit for with me about, number one, about the species differences that you saw, and number two, about the overall role thatch and organic matter accumulation plays in the nitrogen process.
Sure. You know, that study came about because when Eric did his work, we looked at late fall applications of nitrogen, you know, and there's been some research lately that says that late fall, you know, is not a very good idea from an environmental standpoint, that uptake's going to not be as good and so on. But in his work, and his late fall was, you know, November like 5th or 6th in Michigan, so that's pretty late. What we found was that the thatch really seemed to suck up a lot of that nitrogen. It had a really high percentage compared to what we would expect, and it was just kind of holding it all. So it kind of led to the question, well, then what happens if you have a species that doesn't form much thatch? What happens with, you know, like a perennial ryegrass, for instance, that doesn't really have thatch? Does it then, you know, allow more nitrogen to go through and into the soil, and when you expect to see more nitrate leaching out of that system than one with thatch? So Morton's work was looking at, we again, kind of intact cores, and we would treat them with a labeled nitrogen and then pull those cores at four different times over the next year to see where that nitrogen was. And what was interesting there was that really the mat layer of ryegrass, which you don't think of being, you know, was a pretty good sink. I mean, about half as effective as the thatch in terms of holding in. So the thatch in Kentucky bluegrass would have maybe twice the nitrogen that the mat layer had. But the mat layer actually still contained an appreciable amount of that nitrogen, even up to a year later.
Huh. So what's interesting about that now is, of course, on putting greens and other golf course turf, where they're actually managing primarily to maintain a mat layer. I'm wondering how some of this then translates to sort of the nutrient management we do in sand-based systems where, you know, we're constantly diluting the thatch. I would assume, based on what you said, that, you know, kind of what we've seen with ryegrass would then apply to some of these golf turf putting green situations.
Well, I think what it says is that, you know, grasses in particular that we work with are really good at producing and sequestering that organic carbon. And so one of the reasons why we have to top dress so frequently on putting greens is because even though you've got this sand, it starts building up that organic matter very quickly. And so you've got to top dress continually to kind of keep that diluted. Otherwise, it'll take off. And I don't think the fertilization is going to make a huge difference, but certainly I think fertilizing optimally, which is moderately, will give you the most production of that material. So that's, you know, one reason why I think superintendents have tried to work levels down lower and lower is to prevent that a lot of that organic matter from accumulating there.
And before we go to the break, I just want to ask you this one last question about that organic matter, because when you look at your mass balance stuff, you know, you're collecting 60, 70, 80% of the total that you apply. And certainly the denitrification that you speak of, certainly that Brian speaks of and to a certain extent Morton speaks of in this paper, I'm sort of interested in your response about, okay, that's, you're losing 20% that we can't necessarily account for through denitrification in some way. Do you think that we're going to get to the point reliably when we can rely on that N that also builds up in that thatch layer, as well as the carbon?
In terms of relying on it for fertilization purposes or
yes, relying on it as a background, as literally a background slow-release product.
Yeah, absolutely. I think... In my opinion, turf turfs in general are one of the best systems for sequestering carbon and nitrogen. They go together. They go hand in hand. So this is why when you start off with a brand new golf course and you've got, let's say, sand-based putting greens, you're going to have to fertilize those like crazy for the first several years to get the growth that you need until that system builds up the organic matter, which is, again, both carbon and nitrogen, that will allow it to kind of then fertilize itself. And so there was a really good paper done. Actually, I think it was out of Cornell by this guy Porter about looking at the – he was looking at carbon, but essentially it's the same thing. Carbon and nitrogen are linked. And he showed that if you look at a lawn over the first, say, 30 years, you're going to be building carbon and nitrogen. And then after you've had 30 years of that lawn growing, you're going to kind of start to reach maybe not so much, think of it as a steady state and maybe increasing, but it's very slowly at that point. And so as you reach that steady state, then you've got a lot of turnover that's supplying the bulk of the what I always tell my students in class is that, you know, the soil provides about 2/3 of the nitrogen that the plant needs, and you're going to put on about 1/3 of it. So we think we're really manipulating it. We're actually just kind of touching up on the edges. It's the soil that provides the bulk of the nitrogen that the plant uses. So.
Okay. And when we come back after this break, we'll get into the way we supplement, both the method of application and delivery, and even some information about the source when we come back speaking frankly with Professor Bruce Branham.
Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone, all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and playable. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
And welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and turfnet.com. And we're speaking frankly with Professor Bruce Branham, and we've laid some really good groundwork here for just general thinking about understanding nitrogen behavior in the soil, the fate, the mass balance, how we supplement. And Bruce ended with some really interesting fact there about how much we're actually supplementing. And so, Bruce, what I want to transition to now is really some of the work you've been doing in the last bunch of years looking at, you know, comparing sources of N like UMAX, UFLEX, and urea, comparing the way those nutrients are applied, and then comparing maybe some of these products that are designed primarily for foliar. So let's start with your the work you've done looking at separating out urea versus what I believe is referred to as stabilized urea, which has a urease inhibitor associated with it. So why don't you talk for a minute about that work you did with UMAX, UFLEX, and urea.
Right. We did a similar study again with labeled product. So again, one of the hard parts of nitrogen work is that, you know, there's so much nitrogen in the soil and so on that when as researchers, if you're trying to say, okay, I'm going to put down a pound of N, how much do I recover in the leaf clippings? Well, it's really hard to tell if you don't have a label. That's the first thing. You have to have a label because otherwise, you know, as I just mentioned, the soil supplies 2/3 of the N that you're going to get. So when you're putting down a pound of N, that's really not very much compared to what's there. It's hard to trace that without. So what we do is we use a labeled product. N15, and so we made the UMAX as it would be normally formulated. You know, so we had granules that were essentially UMAX, but they had N15 on them, and we compared that to urea. And the idea is that UMAX is supposed to, A, prevent urea from being hydrolyzed or slow that down, and also to ammonia, and then prevent the ammonia from being nitrified to nitrate. So it has two ways of trying to slow down that conversion and help hold that. That's why they call it stabilized urea. Hold that in place so the plants can have more opportunity to get to it before everything else does.
Right. So hold on. So for all intents and purposes, It is a I know they don't like to call it slow release nitrogen, but for all intents and purposes, it is slowing the release of an otherwise relatively rapidly released form of nitrogen.
That's the theory, or that's the yes, that's the way it's supposed to work. You're right. It's not truly a slow release product, but it is a product, as you accurately put, that slows down the conversion of the ammonia of the urea to other forms. And it's worked in, it actually does work in certain situations, but I guess what I would say is that in the turf setting, we did not see any real benefit to it. So particularly when you're irrigating, because as soon as you irrigate, you're starting to separate that granule, the components that are going to stop that urea from reacting. You're separating those out. You're dissolving them and moving them out. And so the benefits become much, much less. And so I always tell people that where I think there may be some value is if you have like unirrigated rough and you put this in particularly, you could put that out and maybe see some benefit where you might get a little more response than what you would if you just put out straight urea. But if you're a golf course superintendent and you're fertilizing your fairways with nitrogen, you want to use urea, that would be a better choice because, what do golf course superintendents do? They put down a product, they immediately water it in. So that watering gets rid of any of the benefit.
And also UMAX and UFlex, I believe you can solubilize those and spray those as well.
Yes, you can. And that's then there's like, it's almost like, what are you doing? Because you're dissolving them, you're removing the good stuff from the urea.
As soon as the UMAX encounters water, the effect of the urease inhibitor, based on your work, is reduced.
I would say that's correct, yes.
Okay, so that's got to be good for
budgets. I would tell somebody, if you're going to dissolve it, then there's absolutely no benefit to using it.
Okay. Well, so that's one discussion of a very common source that we'll, hope we don't get sponsorship from the company that's developing UMAX. But let's move on to before I go to the most recent USGA report that I've seen that you put out there, Bruce, I want to go to this foliar nitrogen work that you did because, a pal of yours and a pal of mine who we love to, razz about certain things, has also ventured into the foliar uptake work as well as the late Chris Stiegler at Arkansas and, of course, some of the original landmark work Bowman did many years ago, looking at, uptake of urea yep. through perennial ryegrass. And now you've thrown your hat into the fray. And as a formerly trained weed scientist myself, I can see that your weed science application technology thinking hat went on, which is if you really want stuff to go in through the leaves, you've got to apply it in much less water. And would you take us through, what you did and what you found regarding the foliar N and how it's different than what others have found in this area?
Sure. We wanted to look at the factors that might affect foliar N uptake. And again, we're looking at what gets into the foliage. So in other words, you go out and you spray your product and, how's that? So what affects how much gets in the plant? That's what I'm trying to say. And so the first thing we looked at was spray volume, because I know a lot of golf course superintendents sometimes use, 80 gallons per acre. They'll use fairly high spray volumes to reduce possibility of drift and so on. We went 20, 40, 60, 80, 100 gallons of water in spray, and we found that the lower the volume of water, the better uptake we got. So conversely, the higher gallonages we saw, often as like the difference between 100 gallons versus 20 would cause maybe over a twofold difference in uptake. In other words, you get twice the uptake at the low spray gallons as you would at that high spray gallons. And it kind of makes sense to me that particularly at those higher volumes, you're probably running some of that material right off the leaf surface initially, and it's not even staying on the leaf. So I think it would, if you're trying to optimize uptake, you need to work probably around 40 gallons or less per acre.
So that's a gallon per thousand or less. So that's the one component. The other component is the absolute amount. And I know that, you know, when you were writing up the paper, as I was reviewing it, you know, you were very careful to try to draw distinctions as to why, you know, you were seeing numbers that might have been different than what others have seen. Do you think it's because of the volumes you sprayed at, or do you think that there was something else going on relative to methodology? Or I think you even alluded to the work that Chris did at Arkansas, maybe influenced by warmer temperatures and change in the cuticle in the south.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at all the papers that have been out there, what you see is that, you know, anywhere from, you know, 10% up to maybe 50% uptake directly into the leaves from a night. So if you're putting on, you know, let's say, a tenth of a pound of in, you may have anywhere from 0.01 up to 0.05 pounds actually get into the plant out of that tenth of a pound. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm saying is, yes, that's the range that you have to deal with. And there's a lot of things that are going to affect that. And so, you know, to expect that everybody's going to get, you know, about 30% is probably unrealistic, because you've got differences in temperature, differences in relative humidity. All those things are going to affect how fast those things get into the plant and how much gets into the plant. So it's really it's going to be variable. Depend upon, you know, if you're spraying at 6 in the morning, you're going to have different results than if you're spraying at noon.
So this makes it a little tricky, and SB, you know, I want, just before we go to the next break, you know, I want to be clear about something that, you know, because the next bunch of questions when we come back for the break is going to be about, you know, products designed to enhance foliar uptake, and but before we go to the looking at the products that are designed to do that, basically what I've heard you say is, you know, hanging your hat on a truly completely foliar approach to feeding is going to, number one, require you to spray differently, and number two, be sort of unpredictable based on when you apply, and maybe not the most efficient way to supply the plant with nitrogen.
Well, you know, Frank, it all depends on how you look at it, because, you know, leaves are not the absorbing organs, roots are. But the problem with roots is that there's a whole lot of other things competing for nitrogen in that soil besides just the roots. So when you put down fertilizer as a granule, let's say, you're probably only going to get 20 to 30% of that into the plant if you're fortunate. So when you spray directly into the plant, that's really good. That's as good as you're ever going to do with a granular product. And you're then going to eventually turn on the irrigation and wash the remaining, the other 70% that didn't get into the plant is going to go back into the soil and behave just like a normal fertilizer application would. So you're going to get much better efficiency from foliar approaches simply because you're circumventing that, having to deal with all those competing units that are in that soil, you know, the microorganisms that are going to try to take in that nitrogen, the other ways that nitrogen can volatilize and get out of the system. So it does give you better efficiency, but it's just not, you know, you're not getting 100% into the plant, and I think you're lucky if you get 30 to 50% would be a successful application.
Okay. All right, and when we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation with Professor Bruce Branham at the University of Illinois, talking about his most recent work looking at products designed for foliar uptake. Stay with us.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Visit MaximusAeration.com.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University and TurfNet.com, and we are wrapping up a very lovely conversation about nitrogen with my old friend Bruce Branham, professor at the University of Illinois. And before we went to the break, Bruce was really alluding to the efficiencies of the various products that we apply in a liquid form, and if we want to maximize the uptake from a foliar perspective, obviously the strategy that we use to apply it in spray volume, as well as timing and temperature and the environmental factors play in. But we have a collection of products, Bruce, that you've tried in the last couple of years to evaluate that are designed for more foliar uptake. And you have a wonderfully nice USGA Taro article here from March and April of this year, where you looked at a collection of products, including urea and ammonium sulfate, and I'm assuming here also an unfertilized control, but you'll clarify me on that. You had some interesting results here, but let's start out by setting it up. We've sort of already said, you've said, and your work has said, that foliar uptake might have its limitations or variability associated with it. Let's start out with the hard question. How much do products designed for, told to be designed as true foliars or foliar uptake products, how much do they actually enhance their effectiveness, either uptake or otherwise?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm not really prepared to fully answer yet until we get the results of this study. I find that we often talk about studies before they're completed, after we've done 2 or 3 years worth of work, and the conclusions change sometimes. So I'll say that as a caveat. I think that going in, my skepticism in me was saying there's really not anything there. In other words, they're going to be no better than urea. And urea, by and large, is pretty good. It gets you maybe 80% of the way there. But I think there are some additives in a lot of these products that have some value, that have some merit. I don't know if they're worth the extra cost, you might say, but we do seem to see consistently some better quality, better color, and just better turf out of some of those foliar products that are the industry type foliar products. So,
and when you did this work, I'm assuming that, you were, because I can't see all of it, and I think it says you actually equalized all the nitrogen rates for the products.
Correct. Yeah. So we're putting on the same amount of N. Now, a lot of these products have other, they may have sulfur, they may have manganese, they may have other ingredients that are going to give you a color response and a quality response as well, but. So we could only match the N rates, but the N rates were matched, and we did see some, statistically significant differences between these products. So, again, I think there could be some other things, that are in there that are giving them better results, is the way to put it.
Well, so what I want to draw attention to is, number one, you measured clippings for this entire data set that's in here pretty much from June until September, and for a couple of dates in between, didn't really see a lot of differences there. But the other thing I found interesting was really the urea and the iron seemed to do well towards the latter part of the season, whereas maybe some of the foliar products did a little bit better towards the earlier part of the season. I don't want to put you on a spot too much and make you, go too far liberally with the data, but certainly it's suggesting something. Would you care to speculate on what you think is going on there?
Well, you know, part of it is the natural growth cycle that we see. What I was surprised is, you know, we had an untreated control, so we're receiving no nitrogen. And by the time you get into late August, early September, it starts to look pretty decent. So I think you're getting, that's where, again, where, remember I was talking earlier in the program about how much the soil contributes to fertility. And so, you know, when you get in the middle of that summer and then after the peak of the heat where and you're on the downslope, I think you see a lot of turnover of that organic matter. And so you get a lot of natural growth. And I think that helped the control plot and maybe helped those urea plots kind of kick it up a little bit and get equal to some of those other foliar treatments that were looking better earlier on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And my sense is that, you know, it's a perfect way to sort of start to tie this up as we wrap up the episode, Bruce. We sort of ended where you started, which is how do we figure out, you know, ultimately the sort of art of this still that lies in front of us is, you know, how do we inform superintendents, you know, when we know the soil is going to be contributing. I think we're still learning about, you know, how that contribution is made from the soil. But what is our role in smartly supplementing that one-third, if you will, that you suggested there with the variety of granular products or liquid products that can be applied in a lot of water as just a liquid mm-hmm. fertilizer or applied in less water as a trying to take advantage of some foliar absorption. So everything you've said has made really good sense. And I guess what I'd like to see you try to nail down here for the tough question is, you know, what kind of a nitrogen fertility program would you recommend for a guy with, you know, a push-up green that he's been sand top dressing for 20 years or so, mixed in a bent poa? What would you recommend as a nitrogen strategy from a source and application perspective?
I guess, Frank, the thing that I've found is that we're, as scientists, we're usually behind the practitioners. And I think the spoon feeding idea really has a lot of merit. And so I say foliar in the sense that it's not so much that it has to be foliar. It's the fact that it has to be a liquid application. Because in order to apply a tenth of a pound or 500ths of a pound of N on a week or 2 week basis, you're going to have to do it through a liquid application system. You can't do that with a granule product. And I think what that does is, you know, you do get some foliar uptake efficiencies that give you better access to that nitrogen initially. So you're getting a higher efficiency out of those foliar applications because of the fact that if you're putting them on the foliage, you're getting that uptake. And then the thing that I find about, you know, that gives you the superintendent the control of being able to look and see how the grass is growing and see how the grass is responding and decide if he needs more in or less in. So I love as a grower having that capability of just adjusting on the fly. Because I feel, you know, it's not physiological to put on a pound of N at a time. That's not the way grasses evolved. They're not used to that. I don't think they take good advantage of it. I think it creates problems. So I try to avoid those large applications on highly managed athletic turf. And so I would say, you know, if you have to do that, maybe you put on a half pound at some point in the October time frame to get you a base there, but then from the rest of the time on, I think it's just you go liquid and once or twice a month. I mean, excuse me, once every week or every other week, and just give it the in that it needs. What I'm seeing too from this study is that you can get probably 80% to 90% of the quality that you're getting from some of the let's say formulated, some of the foliar products that you go out and buy, where you're getting somebody who says, you know, oh, this stuff is really, really good. Well, I think there is a little value to it. I guess the question is how much of that value is there, because, you know, you're going to get 80% to 90% of that with urea and maybe some iron. But in turf, that's what we shoot for, is the highest quality. So there's some value there that you have to decide what the price of that value is.
That's right. Okay, Bruce, what a joy. Great to hear from you. Thanks for taking the time to yak with me about this absolutely a subject we can go on forever. And you can be sure we're going to have you back talking herbicides. I want to have another conversation with you about mesotrione and Poacure. And until then, we'll come back in a minute, and I'll wrap up this with some final comments. And welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University and TurfNet.com, and absolutely a comprehensive, exhaustive conversation about nitrogen use in turf, all the way from its role in building organic matter and carbon sequestration through the role that can play as a background fertility tool, whether it's sand-based or soil-based systems, and then our application strategies and the way we have to think about delivering that product, and then ultimately the source of the product. And even amongst that, things we haven't talked about, you know, timing of the year, timing between applications. But Bruce did an excellent job in really outlining, you know, what are the physiological aspects of our turf grass plants that make fertilizing sometimes a real art and not necessarily something we've always got the science on. So thanks for joining us for this episode of Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi and look forward to talking with you on our next episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.